Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM. And now, filling in for Art Bell, here is Barbara Simpson.
Good morning, everybody. Barbara Simpson here in for Art tonight and this morning on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Charles Ostman. Are we talking about the goo that's going to take over the world? Are we talking about a chip that can take over your brain? Is it going to change everything about our lives? Is it even possible? Well, you'd be surprised. What we're talking about is nanotech, biotech, infotech, and cognotech, NBIC. We're finding out what it's all about and how it will affect us, all of us, even now. I'm Barbara Simpson on Coast. Charles Ostman is my guest on Coast. I'm Barbara Simpson. And Charles, you mentioned earlier that NBIC, and you were telling us what you meant by nanotech. Let's do each of them now so we have an idea of what they each are and how they'll play together in our future.
Sure.
When you say biotech, what's the B part of that?
All right. Biotech means it's a very broad area, but it's sort of the precursor to nanotech in a way, but it encompasses the entire range of molecular biology, recombinant proteomics, genetic engineering, the whole enterprise is sort of unraveling, if you will, the mechanics of biological systems and organisms as a way to develop new medical treatments, new drugs, but also to extend further beyond that and to actually harvest the processes that nature uses to construct living things and see if we can mimic those processes in some ways to create new kinds of materials or processes. In fact, the world of nanotech and biotech are really tightly intertwined. In fact, every living thing, in a way, is a kind of a nanofoundry. If you were to open up a cell and look inside, you would find little mechanical components in there called organelles. And these organelles come in different categories, ribosome, proteasome, mitochondria, and so forth. But the basic idea is that these individual little sections of the cell each performs the task of breaking apart and reassembling molecules to suit the physiological requirements of that cell and perhaps of the entire organism. And the instructions, the software that runs this process, comes in the form of proteins. And the proteins themselves have a kind of a numerical sequence embedded in their molecular structure. So it's actually a very beautiful model. Nature's very good at this sort of thing. We are, in a clumsy kind of way, trying to borrow a little bit from that to see if we can extend beyond the range of how we currently use biotech as a kind of a mostly medical industry base and see if we can sort of extend it further to a wider range of applications. But basically, it's the enterprise of manipulating biology to suit various purposes.
Are we playing with fire by doing that, Charles? You know, they always talk about something that gets out of control, and I guess we could talk about that with the genetically modified plants, because obviously that's what people are concerned about. But what about fooling around with people and animals and cloning? And
you know, those are areas that I absolutely agree with you with. These are dangerous areas, and I'm not necessarily up in these areas either. However, I would like to say, I think certainly in areas like stem cell research, I thoroughly support that this is an area we should allow to take place. And I'm sort of miffed and surprised, not to get political per se, but I'm kind of, it's sort of odd that the Bush administration has decided to take such a narrow view of this. I think that the potential for solving a very, very significant number of diseases that we look at right now, diabetes, spinal bifida, various neurological disorders, et cetera, many of which could be remedied by stem cell research. I see no reason not to let this proceed. However, on the other hand, when it comes to creating new kinds of hybrid organisms, especially microbes and even viral organisms, this is where it gets very, very dangerous indeed, because these simpler organisms are much more prone to mutate in ways that we truly don't understand. And I will freely admit that biology is by no means a done deal. We are only beginning in fact, to unravel the full extent of how this biological mechanism really works. In fact, a wonderful example of this was the film Jurassic Park. And if you remember, the Jeff Goldblum character who played this mathematician, chaos theorist, was being shown the dinosaur eggs in the laboratory where they're creating these dinosaurs. And the doctor was suggesting, well, don't worry, these dinosaurs will never, you know, procreate out of control because they're all asexual and they can't. We have to actually clone these eggs. And Jeff Goldblum says, well, you know, life has a way. And it was a wonderful statement because he's absolutely right. The more we unravel about the inner workings of biological systems, the more we begin to marvel at just how complex this really is. And yes, there are these sort of gray zones where if you start playing around with trying to create hybrid strains of microbes, for instance, maybe as a potential medical procedure and ghastly as it is, maybe as a warfare agent, which is something that I really, really am concerned about. Yes, these are areas that we really don't want to be messing around with. And I do agree that there has to be some kind of regulatory boundary put on the basic use of biological resources as a way to create medical breakthroughs, maybe make for, you know, better solutions for energy problems or whatever it might be, versus some of the more precarious areas that we truly don't understand yet. I would certainly agree there's certainly room for closer scrutiny.
How do you control that, though? Because we already have several pseudo-medical groups claiming that they've cloned human babies, even though it's being done in several cases in countries that theoretically at least have outlawed it. And you know as well as I do, if somebody wants to do something, especially given what's available today to people who are not associated with, for example, university laboratories, et cetera, they can pretty much do almost what they want, even though it's illegal.
Well, that's actually a very interesting point. And in fact, this is exactly the kind of thing we discuss in Institute for Global Futures and other places like this where we do these think tank sessions, because one has to kind of come to grips with the new reality. The new reality is this, that in days of yore, most of big science was just that. It was big science, big institutions, big top-down bureaucracies, you know, highly centralized with very specific linear chains of command, and, you know, funding and sort of governmental control was all sort of tied into what got put into the research path and so on.
Right.
This is changing very quickly. And in fact, in the biotech arena, certainly you can go to almost anywhere in the world and have a relatively small laboratory that could easily fit into an average office building, for instance, and you would have exactly what you're describing. You could be inventing cloned organisms, new hybrids that we couldn't even dream of, or conjuring any kind of strange concoction that would seem like something out of science fiction, but in fact, if somebody wanted to pay for it or if there was the motivation, yeah, they probably could do this outside the eyes of scrutiny. This does present a different kind of, not just a problem per se, but a new kind of circumstance that, again, we've never really encountered in our previous history. Is there a single solution for this? Not exactly. But I think that what might come to pass, and I'm just offering a guess as somebody who sits in these kind of think tanks, but it may come to pass that we kind of have to keep a new kind of surveillance going. In other words, as new biological things sort of pop up in the horizon and we discover they exist, we can't possibly control everything that happens, but we might be able to mitigate the effect that some of these sort of ill-fated biological adventures might unleash into the general world, because we have to anticipate them and hopefully develop antidotes. And I'm, again, talking not so much about cloning, because that'll probably happen no matter what happens, but other things that may involve hybrid organisms that are conjured up for some peculiar reason that would not seem logical to you or I, but might fulfill somebody else's interest. Is there a way to neutralize or somehow contain these things once they are unleashed? Yes, I think that kind of global surveillance compliance-y kind of mechanism, I'm not sure how you would implement this bureaucratically, but, so, you know, and I hate to use the United Nations as a kind of an example, because it's sort of a gray zone. It's not necessarily the best model, but something like an international, scientific board that would have the authority to kind of keep an eye on things that were popping up that might represent a threat or some kind of possible misuse to the general world population. I could see something like that maybe in the future becoming more of a mechanism of control, or at least observation, by which we could then somehow get a gander on what's happening.
It's interesting. I found a story just this last week from Santiago, Chile. And the researchers at the university down there are warning the science community that the use of a certain chemical compound when they're cloning animal and human embryos could cause mutation. Apparently, they've tried it in mice, and they have they found these mutations, and they're very concerned that there would be a high probability of mutation during the cloning process. The compound is called 6-DMAP. And they found that when they cloned bacteria with that in the mix, that the bacteria mutated, and they're saying that the chemical is already being used by scientists in South Korea who are researching cloning on mammals. They've already produced cloned pigs, cats, sheep, and cattle, and the concern is that they're in the same laboratory, have cloned human embryos, and that was reported in February. That, to me, is a frightening thing.
Well, and it's only the beginning edge of a gigantic Pandora's box. And this whole idea of having this sort of free-for-all where whoever wants to spend the money can suddenly do this outside the jurisdiction of country X, Y, or Z. In my limited, perhaps, way of looking at this, I think the only way we're going to put a lid on this is to say that if the market forces, as you were describing earlier, the free market, determines that these things are undesirable, then it sort of, in a way, implies a control because if people don't want to buy the end products that these cloning processes produce, then that in itself will kind of put a limit on how effective they are in infiltrating to our general world. But it does require a kind of an awareness on the general public. And unfortunately, this requires a certain level of education amongst the general public. And I say this with great care and respect because I don't want to cause unnecessary offense, but I think there's a lot of folks out there who don't necessarily have much of a scientific background, or any of that for that matter, and yet they capture a few buzzwords on a headline or hear a couple of words on the 6 o'clock news and immediately sort of leap to a conclusion, driven mainly by emotion rather than by a background that would qualify the opinion. This is where it gets very complicated because, unfortunately, the issues at hand are technically very complicated and does require some kind of an entity that can, I know this sounds idealistic, but can render some kind of a neutral opinion based strictly on the scientific facts or the logic of how this came to pass, and then be able to suggest that these things need to be disapproved or approved or allowed in the market under certain conditions.
You're an idealist.
I know. It's a bit hopeless, I understand. But, something, it's just like speed of light or infinity. You'll never quite get there, but you can sort of look to it as a potential goal.
And kind of hope.
At least something along these lines, I think, could be started, and we could add to the process as it goes along. But, the time to get into this process would be now. I certainly would agree with that.
Absolutely. What about infotech? Now, we did the nano and the bio. What's the info, and how closely is that related to the cognotech?
Well, it is, and they're all interrelated. So the infotech comes next. So here's the sort of nutshell. Over the past 20 or 30 years, as I'm sure a lot of people will tell you now, the scale, velocity, and complexity of knowledge management has far, and I mean far, exceeded human capacity to render mission-critical decisions compressed into ever shorter timescales. And this could be placed at almost any level of industry, government, economics, certainly, et cetera. So the process has required, not because it's academically interesting, but just because there's no other way to get around this, a reliance ever more on, and I'm going to say these words carefully, biological metaphors in computing. And what that means is the ability to, in a sense, precognize extremely complex volumes of information and knowledge so that the humans who are at sort of the end of the value chain see the parsed results of whatever the meta-system has revealed or whatever sort of knowledge components are yanked out of this gigantic sort of chaotic realm of information that's relevant to the interest in question. So in a way, we've become symbiotically connected to a very complex infrastructure consisting of networks, computers, and more exotic things like neural networks and genetic algorithms and evolutionary computing, which I can explain a little bit, which behave very much like biological systems, to, on their own autonomously, sort of render forth the reduced version of whatever the knowledge base might happen to be, so that it can be applied by the decision makers, or the humans who think the decision makers, I should put it that way. But you know what's interesting? If you look at the major banks of the world, certainly the most of the major trading houses, Or if you go into the biotech industry, for instance, speaking of biotech, mm-hmm. Roughly 80% of the value chain of most of your major pharmaceutical firms and biotech companies is not in chemistry. It's in informatics. The reason being that the scale of complexity, where they have to simulate unbelievably complex models of biological systems as a way to test the theory of a drug, maybe to discover a new proteomic compound, to mimic the behavior of an organism, et cetera, these are computational challenges which go far beyond computing as it once had been, say, 20 or 30 years ago. So the only way to get at this kind of new level of knowledge management and knowledge processing is to create this sort of meta-systems which will eventually, on their own, kind of autonomously discover or reveal patterns or increments of knowledge that simply wouldn't be apparent through any other means. And now people who are in the risk management business, who are looking at even simulating complex societal systems, certainly the military is extremely big on this for simulating all kinds of, you know, potential battlefield situations and so on.
Sure.
It's amazing how varied and how wide spread this process has become, to the point where we as people, like I said, are kind of almost like appendages attached to, rather than being at the center of, these mechanisms from which this kind of decision rendering is made possible. And in fact, there's a conference every year called GECCO, which is the Genetic and Evolutionary Computing Conference, and it's a huge event. It's a week long, and there are thousands of papers published, and people can do a web search on GECCO and download some information. But the basic point is it's one of many, but it's probably the most prolific conference of its kind. But it's the epitome of this art form. And over the years, it has gone from a very obscure area of information to sort of like the centerpiece, really, of how information processing and how networks are actually managed and will be, of course, in the future.
Are we, this probably sounds silly, but are we getting too smart for our own good?
I think that we are being pushed to a different kind of smartness. This may be not to evade the question, but I'm hoping to give it a different kind of answer. The word smart simply means that you know a lot of stuff.
Right.
It's not how much stuff you know, but how well you know how to use what you already have.
Good point.
So getting back to the original statement, I talked about contextual cognition, that's sort of what I was leading up to. Now, can we actually meet this new kind of evolutionary challenge within the time frame that might be relevant or necessary to really adapt effectively? That could be a question that could be easily, you know, contested. But at least I get a sense of what the problem could be. It's kind of like when you're driving to Las Vegas and you're 50 miles out and you can see the light on the horizon, but you can't quite see the lights in the city yet. It's mm-hmm. kind of like that. We can kind of see the glow of the lights on the horizon. We're not quite sure. We can't quite read the signs yet, but we sort of know it's there, and we get a sense of what we're approaching. So in this realm of complexity management, of process morphology, of convergence, and all these things that are dynamically affecting who we are and what we are and what we're evolving into, to me the challenge isn't so much the smartness as opposed to the contextual cognition of how we're going to navigate our way through this next realm, as it were.
Does it worry you knowing what you know about this and what, I mean, really how exciting the potential for all of this is if you just look at it as this blossoming something and we're not sure where it's taking us? And then on the other hand, you pick up your daily newspaper and you find out how many kids graduate from high school and they can't read and write.
Oh, I know, and believe me. In fact, there if you'll allow me 30 seconds, I'll toss in a plug for my two cents worth and how we're approaching this. I think, speaking for me personally, for instance, I remember when I was about 10 or 11 years old, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I had the privilege of taking a bus, like 2 hours a drive from where I was living. I lived in an area that's kind of mostly farming and that kind of thing, and drove into Seattle and saw the Seattle World's Fair. It was unbelievable. I saw this gigantic, you know, science pavilion and all these, you know, really interesting displays of how stars were formed and how galaxies
right.
worked and physics and all this kind of stuff. And I remember it was like that hominid that touched the obelisk in the 2001 film. It really just woke me up. I mean, I was always kind of a nerdy kid anyway. I freely admit this. But, I mean, that was it. That was like this epiphanal moment. I'll never forget that. And I think that in today's world, if we have the chance to harvest this potential, and I'll give you a couple of metaphors. You know, astronomers talk about dark matter. That is matter that can't be seen spectrographically, but we can tell it's there because of the gravitational forces required to hold the universe together. Theoretically, it has to exist. telecom people talk about dark fiber space capacity. That is like 90% of all the fiber that's in the ground right now still isn't being used. Well, I use a term called dark human resource potential. That is the yet-to-be-recognized potential of many young kids who, if they could be sparked with the right kind of inspiration, there's an enormous harvest potential, but we have to get that spark out there. And I have a couple of projects I've been working on which are focused on that. One of them is called the Future Lab Expo, which is
Hold your thought. and we will elaborate on that because we're at the bottom of the hour, and I don't want you to get started and we'll lose the train on this. That's what we're going to have to do, because we've got a lot of kids out there who need to have that spark so that they can be part of this magnificent future that's ahead of us if we use it wisely. I'm Barbara Simpson on Coast to Coast AM. My guest is Charles Ostman. You stay with us. We'll continue on Coast.
Listening to Coast AM. And now, filling in for Art Bell, here is Barbara Simpson.
We're talking with Charles Ostman about the world of the future that's here today and all of these new technologies that can change literally everything about us and our lives and how we'll go into the future. We'll continue with that, but I do want to remind you about the After Dark newsletter. Have you wondered, given the price of gas now, how high those prices will go this summer? We have a holiday weekend coming up. Can you imagine? Can you imagine how high those prices will be 10 years from now? According to the June issue of the After Dark newsletter, the era of cheap oil is over. Find out why and what we can do about it. Also, you'll get part two of Art's interview with John Lear, George's editorial about MRIs. There's some pretty scary new surveillance technology being developed. You'll hear about that. And the webmaster, Lex Sloanhood's monthly oddities column, only available through After Dark. Subscribe now, and you'll still get the special gift of the free Malachi Martin CD, but that offer ends for certain on June 18th. That date, I am told, is cast in stone. Don't miss out. Call now, 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. Or just sign up online at www.coasttocoastam.com. Just click through the orange type to the secure server or call the phone number, 1-888-727-5505. I'm Barbara Simpson. Talking with Charles Ostman. And Charles, before the break, you were talking about a couple of ways that you had in mind that you could sort of stimulate these young people to be interested and inspire them to learn more about these new technologies, which really will be their life.
It will be their lives, and they have a spectacular potential for shaping our future history. But the whole point is to activate this as we speak, and hopefully in a way that, and like I said, harvests this potential. So one of the projects I'd like to talk about is something called the Future Lab Expo, which was something that the Institute for Global Futures initiated. This is headed by Dr. James Canton, who, by the way, just so you know, he actually wrote there's a document that was published when the NNI was first passing the law. That's the National Nanotechnology Initiative, and you can download this from the government's own website. But it's quite an extensive document, and in that document you have many, many different papers and sort of bits and pieces of different ways of looking at nanotechnology, as it reflects not just on economic and technical things, but also societal implications. And Dr. Canton offered the societal implications portion of that document. A bunch of us folks who are senior fellows there contributed bits and pieces of the research. But what we're leading up to is a way to communicate not just about individual sciences, but also how they fit together. So one of the things that we did was put together something called the Future Lab Expo. It's actually traveling around the country as we speak. It's kind of like a traveling roadshow for science. In fact, here in the Bay Area, there was something called the Next Fest, which just happened a couple of weeks ago. It was a Wired magazine-sponsored event, and they had all these different displays from major corporations and various universities, sort of showing things like energy of the future, nanotech and medicine, just a variety of things. So we did kind of a smaller version of that that actually travels in a big 18-wheeler truck and goes to various high schools, especially high schools that are in economically challenging circumstances or remote areas, that kind of thing, so that the students there could actually sort of see and touch and interact with things that were part of this new realm. And it actually had separate sections on nanotech, robotics, artificial intelligence, biotech, space. There were several different interrelated sections, like little pavilions, but they all had both hands-on displays that you could interact with and had models and things you could do on the computer. There was actually a computer game that was developed based on a film that I produced several years ago about nanotechnology applied for medical purposes. And the basic concept of the game was the body in question is being invaded by various diseases. The person in question has to then solve the disease or the ailment using various sort of nanotech-related solutions, and they get to actually construct a solution on the fly as a way to solve the problem, and the person gets healthy and goes on, or the person doesn't get healthy, they have to figure out why, sort of go through the process. So it's an interesting way to not only activate interest amongst high school kids, but it's also a kind of a cool way to use things like gaming technology for something that was actually educationally beneficial. Not to clamp down the game industry too much, but if you ever have been to a computer game conference, what you'll see mostly are games that involve blowing things up, shooting things, and causing all sorts of mayhem. So the theory was, could we take the same technology and turn it into something equally fun, but with perhaps a more stimulating, you know, long-term benefit? And that's exactly what's been happening. And in fact, it's been very well received. We've had thousands and thousands of students visit it. We've gotten overwhelmingly positive response from teachers and parents and everybody, so we're going to do Future Lab 2 starting next fall.
I think it's a fabulous idea. I'm jealous of the kids having access to that. I think that grown-ups should, too.
Well, actually, there's a lot to be said for that. But for those who want to have a quick look, if I may, I can give the website, and you can go ahead and look yourself. It's called FutureLabExpo.com.
FutureLabExpo,
all one word, .com.
.com. Okay. I will definitely check that out because that sounds fascinating. Now, just out of curiosity, do you promote this ahead of time so that people can sort of look forward to this arriving in their town? Because I must admit, I'm not familiar with it. If it's been in this area, I missed it.
Actually, the only high school that I'm aware of, and I'm not really involved in the organization or marketing. I did some of the technical stuff for the nanotech part of the program.
Yeah.
But I'm just a lowly science nerd. I really wasn't part of the politics or anything. But Dr. Canton, of course, he was the organizer. And since we started this, we've gotten quite a number of new organizations who signed up, everything from the Air Force to various corporations and NSF, and lots of other folks are taking interest in this idea. But the basic, there was actually a schedule published, I believe it was at Miramonte High School, which is in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
That was a few weeks ago, but I don't remember all together how many different states. I know that it was in the Appalachians for a while, it was in the Dakotas, it was in various parts of the country. But if you go to the website, you can actually download a schedule. Now, it's mostly done now because we're heading towards a summer break, but of course,
sure,
before the fall starts, we'll obviously publish a new schedule, and that can be gotten off the website.
That is just a fabulous idea. It really is. Before we finish out this hour, I want to talk a little bit about the artificial intelligence, and you were talking about the cognotech aspect of this.
Sure.
It's all related there. What does that entail?
Okay, sounds interesting.
Yes, and to
kind of give the quick shrink wrap version, going back a number of years, maybe back to the days of Marvin Minsky and some of the original practitioners of the art form, back then, there was an effort to write code, to program computers, to mimic a kind of a behavior that would appear to be intelligent. And I use those words kind of carefully. The whole idea was to create a conversant way of interacting with an entity that seemed like a living thing. So you could talk to it, and it would talk back, and it would give various answers that seemed like a person or whatever. Okay, it was a nice experiment. It was an interesting concept, but it wasn't really intelligence per se. It was a way to model what appeared to be an intelligent response, but the machine itself was very stupid. All it did was mimic whatever it was told to do because you wrote a program to do this. That's very, very different than the current approach, and this is where the nanotech comes in, by the way, to mimic a living thing. And so in the world of what's called artificial life, and if you do a web search, you'll get lots and lots of material on this. In fact, there's a conference every year called A-Life, and I've spoken at a couple of them. But the basic idea is to utilize a new kind of computing architecture called reconfigurable computing. And again, I'm sorry for the buzzwords, but what it means is a computing platform that is soft. That is, it can be reconfigured on the fly. Instead of having to write a bunch of code that predetermines everything that the computer will do, the computer itself kind of can reorganize itself according to its surrounding stimuli. And so the process that makes that possible, or one of the processes, is something called evolutionary computing. So a subset of the artificial life world began to explore the mechanisms by which to make a living thing-like metaphor. And the reason that's important is the following. This is where intelligence really begins. Because rather than pre-coding all of the responses that the computer might do according to what it's interacting with, this creates something quite different. This creates kind of like a living system that will on its own begin to interpret its surroundings and react accordingly. So in the world of evolutionary computing and reconfigurable architectures, a bunch of folks began working on the concept of neural networks, which is a way to mimic what happens in the human brain, or any brain for that matter, but to use evolutionary computing as a way to create a self-evolving neural network, a kind of a living brain of sorts. And in fact, a very famous person by the name of Hugo de Garis, who's quite well known for being kind of a pioneer in this area, he was actually hired by NTT, Nippon Telephone and Telegraph, to create the world's largest artificial brain. This goes back several years. They were going to create a 10 billion neuron artificial brain that would self-evolve by the year 2007. Now, unfortunately, NTT has fallen into some hard times, and they've pulled the plug on a number of their research programs, this being one of them. But a bunch of other folks have proceeded henceforth. And the basic idea is this, that you might start with a system like this that's very dumb because it hasn't really learned anything yet, but its capacity to learn and to evolve and to continue to manifest its own sort of sense of intelligence and a potentially sense of self, that is exactly where this is going. Now, the reality is that in current day terms, the silicon chips that are designed to support this kind of process, the reconfigurable chips, they're called FPGAs, they're kind of expensive, and you need a lot of them to sort of make a robust version of this kind of intelligent system. However, if one goes to a nanotechnology-enabled solution where you can have a vastly higher density of the same kind of process in a much smaller space and also with much less cost, now all of a sudden you begin to create the infrastructure that allows for evolutionary computing and processes like it to create the artificial life that then becomes the mechanism by which the new kind of artificial intelligence, which truly is intelligent, becomes fostered.
But they wouldn't be human, would they?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, one could attach a human face to a mechanical system to mimic human interaction. In fact, people are doing this now. But the reality is that the intelligence can be anywhere. And in fact, the whole concept of self-healing, self-organizing networks, networks that are defensive, networks that become aware of the surroundings and anticipate how to react to potential threats, that kind of thing, that's been going on under DARPA research for quite some time, and I probably wouldn't go there too much further. But in the commercial world, this is already being used, as I was saying earlier, in some of the more advanced areas of informatics. The next stage says, okay, can we confine a example of this to a self-contained entity in a box that might sit on your desktop? And that's exactly where the nanotech comes in, because that allows this kind of process density to become commercially viable.
What would you do with that box?
Well, in a sense, that box becomes an extension of you. kind of the way I was suggesting earlier about extremely complex areas of knowledge and information management as a requirement for the kinds of decision-making that is already well outside the range of human interaction, and we are only like the recipients, really, of the pre-processed knowledge that's fed to us by these systems. Now you've simply confined it to a much smaller, much more affordable, much more granular kind of commodity that the average person could have. And oddly enough, if we are being pressured to exist in a more complex world, this is the kind of symbiosis that allows us to function in that more complex world, perhaps in a friendlier way.
But what would you do with it? I mean, I can't get my brain wrapped around that. What do I do with this?
Well, decision management might be a good start point.
All right.
If you're dealing with complex decisions where you would want to have... Imagine, like, for instance, on Star Trek, you had the Data character, who wasn't a human form and walked around and so on. But nonetheless, he kind of represented sort of the extreme Hollywood version of this concept. But the idea was that Data was a superhuman. He could think faster and process more information and kind of have a better understanding, at least in a technical sense, of his surroundings than his human counterparts. That's kind of why he was there.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, he could do so without the messiness, perhaps, of emotional noise clouding the vision of his judgment. That was the theory, at least, of the Data character.
Exactly. I was thinking exactly that they might be human in the sense of being able to do the rational thinking, but there's no emotion there.
Well, and the idea is that in a sort of an odd kind of way, maybe we have to rely on something outside of ourselves to allow us to navigate through this realm that is becoming more complex than we were originally designed to interact with. That is part of the evolution that we're sort of looking at the edge of as we speak.
Would there be a way... I'm trying to figure out how the box on the desk that can do this kind of thinking could tap into what's already in my brain so that the decision the box on the desk makes is based on the information that I already have inside of me.
We're touching on the edge of Cognotech. So it's a wonderful segue. Thank you, Barbara. That was very well done. Congratulations. the basic idea is this, that as we speak, and I mean today, right now, this minute, the whole scientific arena of neurophysiology, neuroaesthetics, there's a whole series of branches that sort of tap into the same general concept of can we measure, codify, and therefore interface with the actual process of the brain? And the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few examples, not all of which I'll go into right now, but a couple of quick ones. A number of years ago, something called a SQID was developed, a superconducting quantum interference detector. Now, it's a mouthful, but what that means is it was a way to use a very sensitive kind of detector to measure the very subtle sort of electrochemical interactions that occur inside the brain and do so in a very clean kind of way. More recently, certainly specially tuned versions of an MRI camera can do this as well. And in fact, there have been a number of research projects throughout the country and also elsewhere in the world where people are brought in and they're exposed to different kinds of stimuli, different kinds of emotional responses, even in some cases, you know, sexual and so on. The whole point is to see what exactly happens where in the brain and then be able to capture the information and store it as a kind of a data set.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as nanotechnology progresses down the path, the ability to create smaller, easier sort of commercialized versions of this kind of technology is becoming very much close to the edge of being a doable thing. So now one marries that, the ability to sense or detect, and then cross-couples that with the informatics I was talking about a bit earlier, where we can take...
Ooh. Uh-oh. I think the battery went away. Charles, are you there? I think that's what happened. We had a phone problem, as you listeners know, and I got a number of fast blasts on this, that he was having some phone problems, and as a matter of fact, through the program, he's changed a couple of different phones, so I'm not sure which one he was on now, but that may well have been a portable phone, and the battery just died. So my producers will try to work that out, and then in the meantime, and actually, we will, providing all goes well with Charles and we get him back so that we can talk with him and that he has another phone, that we will open up the lines for you, and I'll give you those numbers because if he's back, After the 1 o'clock news, it's actually 1 o'clock here, depending on where you are, but the top of the hour news, that you will be able to ask him some questions directly. And I got to tell you, as I said from the very beginning of this, as he said, there's a lot of jargon in there, a lot of words, and some of it sounds, it can be very confusing. But if you really sort of break it down into what we're talking about, all of these elements that he's explaining are really part of our lives now without our even realizing it. And just think of the programs that we've done on Coast, and I've heard them. I've done a couple myself in the past about the implantable chips, the kind of thing that is already being done. I think they started it probably with animals, you know, identifying your pet. But they're being done with people, and there are all kinds of proposals. The most recent one I heard was that you would have a chip, a sensor put in you so that you wouldn't need a credit card anymore. So it's part of the paperless, moneyless society where you could just walk through a check stand and it would automatically charge your credit card. I don't know that I would want that, but that's, you know, the little bit of some of this technology that is already with us. But there is so much more that could happen. We touched on it briefly in terms of even the medical technology. Charles, are you there?
I'm so sorry. I apologize briefly. Speaking of technology only being what it tries to be in its current form, that was my wireless phone suddenly dying on me. So I do apologize profusely.
That's okay. I thought that's what it was. I wasn't sure. You were talking about this information tapping into what's in our brain.
Well, let me give a couple quick examples. There was a court case, a very famous court case, and I don't have the information on the screen in front of me, but it was the first time ever that a neuromap, and that's another buzzword, but the
you have about
45
seconds.
Okay. That the ability to recognize an event that had occurred or not occurred because of the brain wave patterns that could be processed.
Yeah.
Said that the person who was being accused of murder, in fact, did not commit the crime because the brainwave patterns were not resident in his brain's memory. And he was
really?
Murdered. This actually happened in court. This was almost 2 years ago now.
My goodness, that's astounding. I'd never heard of that, but boy, the lawyers could have fun with that one. We'll talk more. We'll also be opening up our lines for my guest, Charles Ostman. Fascinating subject. You go on for hours and barely scratch the surface. I'm Barbara Simpson on Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.
How high will gas prices go?